Vedanta teacher James Swartz on Bhagavad Gita. An audio workshop brought to you by meinyogalehrer.de, recorded in Yoga Vidya Westerwald Ashram in Germany on March 2013. Part 12 of 13.
Sarva Vedanta Siddhanta Gocharam Tamagocharam Govindam Paramanandam Sadgurum Pranatosmyaham. Narayana Govindam. So we got so far, we realized that we only want, that there's nothing, there's no lasting happiness in the pursuit of objects. Pleasure, security, virtue, fame, recognition, power. There's no lasting happiness there. And that the joy that we do get from objects, the small joy that seems to come from objects, actually comes from the self, from me. Which leads me to conclude that joy or happiness is my nature. And then I begin the search for happiness directly in myself. And when I do that, I come up against two ideas. One idea is that I can experience that happiness by pursuing a spiritual path. Spiritual path being a number of techniques and practices and ideas that will produce the experience of nirvana or samadhi or satori or some permanent state of happiness which I will connect to and find within myself. And we examined that idea and we found that it's not reasonable to assume that a limited entity can produce a limitless result. And since happiness is limitless, then actions are not going to solve my problem. And then we determined that that idea was based upon the notion that reality is a duality and that I'm separate from what I'm seeking. And we didn't quite know where to turn, but when we looked at Vedanta, we discovered that Vedanta said that reality is non-dual and that I'm always connected to what I'm seeking. I'm always experiencing happiness all the time. I'm always experiencing bliss. I just don't know it. And that led us to the idea that I have an ignorance problem. I'm ignorant of myself. And I don't have an experience problem. I'm just not in tune or in touch or understand what I'm actually feeling and experiencing. That the bliss that I'm looking for outside in some experience or some object is going on in me all the time. This joy or this happiness in my nature. And the only access to that joy or happiness is through knowledge. And then we said that for knowledge to happen, you need a means of knowledge. The means that we've been given by God, our senses, our heart, and our mind, is not suitable for awareness, for knowledge of the self. Because the self is not an object, the self is the subject. So we need a special kind of means of knowledge for the subject. And it so happens there is such a means of knowledge, and that's Vedanta. It's a proven means of knowledge which takes away my ignorance of who I am. And how does it do that? In revealing to me the unexamined logic of my own experience and removing my ignorance about myself. Myself means the world outside, my mind, and consciousness. The self being everything, I need complete knowledge. And I need not knowledge just of pure awareness, I need knowledge of my mind, and I need knowledge of the material world. Jiva, Jagat, Ishwaraha. I need a full, complete knowledge, so I need a full means. For that knowledge to work, we said, you need to be qualified. And we listed those qualifications: discrimination, dispassion, control of the mind, control of the senses, swadharma, doing your duty, your own duty, samadhana, one-pointed focus or attention for a considerable period of time, titiksha, forbearance, burning desire for liberation, and faith in the scripture. If I have these qualifications and I'm in this situation, I don't want anything on the outside, I've got, I found the teaching, then I need a teacher. The teacher needs to be qualified also. Teacher should be established in the self as the self and be able to communicate the teachings according to the tradition. In Vedanta, the teaching is also determined by the tradition. I can't teach it my way. I'm not even teaching Vedanta my way. I'm making the method of Vedanta interesting and attractive to you, but I'm teaching according to the traditional method. Even the teaching itself is not personal. Understand? It's called the Sampradaya. The Sampradaya is the lineage or the structure that consciousness has put in place to keep the knowledge pure so that it can't get contaminated by individuals. The teacher should be established in awareness as awareness and should wield the means of knowledge that effectively and should... My brain just went fuzzy. And should be a compassionate person. An approachable person that you can express your questions and doubts to. If all those things are in place, then I know I'm on the Vedanta bus. I receive teaching. Well, how do I receive teaching? I put aside, just like when we come in here, we put aside our shoes at the door. I put aside all my ideas at the door. You can pick them up afterwards. When I come in, I should put all my ideas outside and just hear what the teaching is without judging it, without interpreting it, without evaluating it. I shouldn't like it, I shouldn't dislike it. I should just clearly hear. And then once I've heard what it is, I go outside, I pick up my old bundle of ideas, and I look at my ideas in light of the teaching. And I throw away those ideas of mine that are not in harmony with the truth. And I keep those ideas that are in harmony with the truth.
How can we be sure to keep the teaching clean? So it will be mixed up in a week or two with all my other thoughts. Now I have the feeling of a clear understanding, but in a few weeks it will be.
That's right. Well, you have
own thoughts.
It pays to stick with the teacher and with the guru as long as you can. I spent every day for 2 years, from about 4 in the morning to about 11 at night. And long past when I knew when I was clear, I just kept at it over and over and over again because, as you say, those old vasanas come up, you lose your focus, you get confused, your ignorance comes back, and you and you lose your way again. So you should keep in touch with the teaching every day. You should study the scripture, read, contemplate carefully using the teachings over every day, just a maintenance all the time. If you can come to the seminars, you know, you can watch my videos. Videos are very good. The videos are almost as good. My wife even liked the videos better than listening to me. She said, I can rewind the I can't rewind you. Well, you can rewind me. I can go back and sort it, but
better to rewind than to go fast forward. That's it.
And so I'm on the bus, and as I do this, continually contemplating, looking at my fears and desires, my ideas and so forth, in light of the teaching, dismissing those ideas and integrating those, cleaning up my mind, at some point, it all comes together. There's a click, it all makes sense. That's called assimilation. The knowledge becomes mine. And it just becomes part of me. It becomes me. And from that point on, you don't have to do any work. The knowledge does the work. You're off the hook. See, knowledge does not, your ego does the work. The ego can sit back and enjoy its life. And the knowledge will do the work for it. You don't want to end up your whole life being a little Vedanta computer. You want to get out there and live your life. Then, assuming all these qualifications, you're taught what the self is. And we had a little discussion of what the self was. Limitless, non-dual, ordinary, ever-present, unconcerned, unborn awareness. We also talked a few other terms, discussed a few other words which indicate what the self is. And that's not so hard. To understand the self is not that difficult. Well, it may be because you can't see it or smell it or taste it. But by listening carefully, you can understand that what it is. And you should understand that it's me. Accept it as your identity, that I am limitless, unborn, non-dual, ordinary, unconcerned awareness, the non-experiencing witness, and I should go off and enjoy myself, live my life. Unfortunately, it's not always that easy. Only maybe 1 in 100 persons who hear it get it like that, and it's very easy. To the rest, there's still some work to do. Still some cleansing, some cleaning, some purifying of the mind. We call it sadhana. Sadhana is the means of attainment. Sadhana means what you use to get what you want. How you attain it. Well, what are we going to attain with sadhana? We're not going to attain enlightenment. We're going to obtain a pure mind. So yoga is beautiful. Yoga is essential and necessary. It will get you ready. It will prepare you and make you pure and clear. So Vedanta recommends yoga. Now yoga means what? Yoga means manipulating the relative proportions of rajas, tamas, and sattva in the mind to get a predominantly pure mind. And what is the first yoga, the base yoga, that I need to have in place before I continue, or while I'm working? Karma yoga. We discussed karma yoga. We've been through that for the last 3 or 4 days. We've been talking only karma yoga. That means what? Karma yoga means that everything I do becomes a spiritual practice. whatever I do, brushing my teeth, walking the dog, taking out the garbage, going to my work, taking care of my children, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. All actions are the same as far as karma yogi. There was a great weaver, there was a butcher, there was a prostitute in India, a king, great king. All of them did karma yoga and got moksha. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you do. Right? According to whatever karma and desires you have, you act in this spirit. Karma yoga is a spirit of dedication, a spirit of contribution, spirit of sacrifice and surrender. What? To Ishwara. What do I surrender to Ishwara? Ishwara means the field of act, a field of my environment, to my life. And what do I surrender? I surrender the fruits of my action. I do my action. I have a duty to do an appropriate and a timely action. If my actions are inappropriate and not timely, then I won't produce the result I want at all. If my actions are appropriate and timely, I may get the result that I want and I may not, depending on the nature of the field. But if I want to maximize my chances to get what I want, and we're all for getting what you want. You should get what you want. We hope you do get what you want from the world. Right? Then what should I do? I should let go, I should do my action, and not worry about whether I get what I want. Now, if I'm worried and anxious about getting what I want, I do an action and I'm worried, how's this going to happen? What's going to happen? Say I want a relationship and I call up my person I met in the cafe, huh? You know, and I really want to meet them for coffee and I really want to get close to them. Huh? And I get really nervous. Huh? I get too excited because I'm too worried about the result. I haven't done my karma yoga. And when I call up, I'm so nervous and so shaky, the person on the other end thinks, what's wrong with this person? They're not normal at all. Listen to that strange voice. What? Huh? And they'll say, oh, this is very nice, but you know, I'm just busy. It's nice to meet you. Bye. But, you know, had I like turned over the result to Bhagwan, and I said, okay, Bhagwan, whatever happens, it's up to you. If I'm supposed to meet this person, if we're supposed to get together, that's up to you. I'll just give it all to you and just call up very normally, just be a normal person, speak very nicely, and see what happens. If she says yes, great. If she says no, great. You didn't want me to meet her, you're probably saving me from a lot of grief. thank you very much, and off you go. You did your action, you see? Because if you have this anxiety, this worry, the next action that's coming, and there's always another thing to do, huh? The next action that you do, your mind will be disturbed. Because you'll be worrying about the action you just did and whether it's going to bear fruit for you. And then you won't do this action in an appropriate and timely way. You'll not do this one properly either. And that will make what? That will make sure that the result doesn't come. Because to get results in this world, you have to act appropriately and timely. You have to do the right action at the right time. If you don't do that, you'll never get anything. Because this is a big machine. It's a big cosmic time machine. And you have to put your little energy in there at the right time in the right place. And then maybe you get the result. And when the result comes back, I take it as prasad. And what does that do? That produces a sattvic mind. That makes my mind steady and clear. Because with every action, I remove one vasana. Each action, right, the vasana goes out. Since I'm not worried about the result, the action is neutralized. No new vasana is generated. No new vasana will come back. Because why? Because there was no ego and desire involved in it. I consecrated the action and gave it to Bhagavan. I truly just said, this is up to you. And all that tension and anxiety and fear and desire doesn't get replicated and go back and force me to do that kind of action again. So my mind slowly, slowly, slowly gets more and more quiet. And instead of being extroverted, my mind slowly, as I work, turns inward, and I start to feel more and more and more relaxed and peaceful. The stress disappears, the tension goes away. And then my mind is what? Becomes contemplative. So I have the karma yoga. Now what is jnana yoga? For each of these three centers, there's a yoga. Okay, we have three inner centers. Karma yoga, what does it do? It takes care of the doer, the ego. The ego is that part that wants results and actions. So for karma yoga, now I've got a yoga for the ego. That gets it in, that puts it in place. What about for the mind, the emotions? Bhakti yoga. Now karma yoga is bhakti yoga because my actions are dedicated, but bhakti yoga is also, right, converting my emotions into devotion for Bhagavan. Not just through my actions, but in other ways. Worshipping Bhagavan, for example, as a symbol, as a form. There's two kinds of bhakti. There's guna bhakti and para bhakti. Guna bhakti is according to my guna, according to my nature, sattvic, rajasic, and tamasic nature. I will worship Bhagavan. Now, what kind of a symbol or a form, and para bhakti is what? Non-dual understanding. Knowing that what I'm worshiping and the one that's worshiping are one. That's the goal. That's formless bhakti. There's no form involved in that. It's purely by understanding that I see that what I'm actually worshiping is me. But I may not be at the beginning of my practice. I may not have that degree of sensitivity, that degree of understanding to see that what I actually love is myself. So what do? I choose a symbol of myself. Well, we have all these self symbols around here. Huh? Notice? Your environment should be full of self symbols. Everything in your environment should refer to yourself. The problem with our societies is, when we are out in the societies, nothing points to the self, does it? Everything just refers to it, to what? To what it does. Even churches don't remind you of God. Well, over here they do a little bit. But in America you can't tell the difference between a church and an insurance office. Or a dental clinic. You're not sure if that's you. You're going to the dentist or you're going to church. It looks the same. Everything has no spiritual direction or pointing to it. Well, what should I choose as a symbol to worship? Anything I want. Why?
It's all Bhagavan anyway.
Because reality is non-dual and everything's Bhagavan. Isn't it? So whatever inspires me to understand, to feel connected, to the self, or to contemplate on the self, or to get my mind running in the direction of the self, I choose that to worship.
And that would mean when I'm very unhappy in the environment I live, and I'm very unhappy with me?
Pardon? Yes, you're unhappy with you when you're unhappy with the environment.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the environment is you. Yeah, isn't it? So you want to create an environment that what makes you happy? What kind of environment makes you happy? An environment that reminds you of who you are. That points to who I am. And so you need to, this is why people usually start with their bhakti in the spiritual world, with nature worship. Huh? In the West, that we don't have much of a religious culture anymore. It's almost all gone. It's like a materialist culture. So the spiritual people here, a lot of those spiritual people are nature worshipers. I think in Germany it's a big thing. The Green Party started a long time ago. People started really could really see God in nature and see how God was being destroyed by this material world, and they started to like look after nature. And so by contemplating on a tree or a river or a sunset or in a mountain or any one of these things, and involving yourself with those symbols, they remind you, or they become what? Symbols of myself, and they unlock that feeling of love in me. Because what we want to do is get our love flowing. Why do people have, like babies? Why do people like babies? They're the most beautiful symbols of yourself, aren't they? Huh? You look at a baby, the baby is dumb as a loaf of bread. Really? They know nothing. They're so stupid, but they're so beautiful. Huh? No, they're not wise. They're beautiful. They're beautiful. Like, I was on the airplane the other day, and there's this little tiny baby. It couldn't have been more than 2 months old. And I smiled at that baby, and the baby smiled back. That baby didn't know me. And the parents, after a while, the baby was just loving me. And the parents got jealous. The baby couldn't see the self in them. But the baby could see myself, the self in that baby could see the self in me, and I could see the self in the baby, and the self was smiling at the self. Huh? There wasn't any filter. I'm like a big baby. At least my wife says I am. I'm like a big baby myself. And I don't have any filters. And I could, so he could see that baby could see it, and I could see it right there. The baby didn't have much of a brain, but the self was shining there, and how beautiful it was. And we just sort of smiled for like 5-10 minutes until the parents got jealous and took the baby away. They even thought, huh? I don't know what they thought. They just jealous, that was all. So I should choose a symbol that gets my love flowing. Dogs. I heart dogs. Why? Why do you heart dogs? Because dogs are they've got all the qualities of the self. Huh? And they're not like human beings. They don't particularly nag you and give you all kinds of, grief. They just love you no matter what. You whack them, and then 5 minutes later, they're back there. So you need something to love. That's the point. Now, if you can, I love Vishnu, and I chant Vishnu's name a lot. I got your chanting book, and I found some chants that I hadn't chanted for years, and they suddenly came back to me. And what does that do? That symbol, that name of God, we call it churning the milky ocean. Milky ocean means the ocean of bliss inside. Because every time you say the Lord's name, the Lord responds. That's why you feel blissful and high when you chant. Because you're invoking the self, and the self likes to hear its name, and what does it do? It gives you a little bliss. And the more you love or worship the Lord with the Lord's name, the more the Lord likes it, and pretty soon you get in a really, really high, powerful, loving state of mind. And what will happen when you're in this, when your emotions are connected to what? To yourself through a symbol. Well, they're not going to be connected to worldly objects. Your bhakti, your love for the Bhagavan will grow. Understand? And in this way, by choosing a symbol and having a devotional practice, a guru, the scripture, read your scripture every day, not just for knowledge, for love. Did you know people say, oh, Vedanta, they're all intellectuals. That's all. They don't have any love, those people. They're all in their heads. But I'll tell you this. Study of the scripture and study of Vedanta is the highest act of devotion you could do. Why? You think it's not bhakti? The love of the truth is the highest bhakti, and you want to know Bhagavan. You don't want to just, what, remain separate and worship Bhagavan. You want to know and understand who Bhagavan is. What more devotional practice is there than what? Study of the scripture, study of the knowledge. So in this way, you channel all of your emotional energy away from objects and put it into the self. So karma yoga is going to link my ego to awareness. See in the heart? See the little om in the middle? That's the inner self. That's called the jivatman, or the inner self, the immanent self. This is the transcendent self. This is the nirguna, and this is the saguna self. This is a self associated with the subtle body. It's in the heart. You see, it's in the middle, but in this triangle here, between these three centers, the mind, ego, and intellect, in the center is the heart. And now karma yoga has put my ego in touch with the self. Bhakti yoga is getting my love flowing toward the self. And jnana yoga is going to get all of my thoughts flowing toward the self. In other words, all three aspects of my being are going to be yoked. This is why it's called yoga, are going to be yoked or joined to one point, my heart. Heart means essence. We're not talking feelings here. The feelings are all what? Flowing toward my essence, toward myself, toward me. My thoughts are all flowing toward me, and my actions are all, what, consecrated and dedicated and flowing toward the self. So I'm completely integrated. This is called integral yoga. I'm completely integrated because all three of my equipment are working together behind a single, for a single purpose, for toward a single goal. Understand. We people say, oh no, I don't want to do that bhakti. That's emotional. That's not good. I'm an intellectual. I'm going to stick with jnana yoga. Or the bhaktas, they say, oh, that jnana yoga, that's all intellectual. I just want to love God. Well, hey, it's not like that. Everybody's got these three inner centers. Everybody's got a heart. Everybody's got a mind, and everybody's got an ego. Everybody, it's all the same for everybody. And you want to develop them all together. You want to get them all developed together, all working together, growing in all parts of yourself, growing in knowledge, growing in love, and growing in what? Service and action. Now, what is jnana yoga? Jnana yoga is what? Self-inquiry. Jnana yoga is called discrimination. in every situation, discriminating awareness from the reflection of awareness. And I think on the first or second day, I described, talked about how gave you the image of the metaphor of the sun and the moon, and how the moon is reflected awareness, is reflected light, and the sun is the source of the light. Well, pure awareness is the source, and the subtle body is the moon. It's reflected awareness, and I'm confusing the objects that appear in the subtle body in the reflection of awareness with myself. What belongs to the subtle body? Fear, desire, pleasure, pain, fantasy, everything. All your thoughts and feelings all belong in the subtle body. That's where they come from. They're rooted in, they don't exist in me, in awareness. So at the same time I'm worshiping God, I'm also thinking about God, and I'm discriminating for the purpose of separating my not-self from myself and getting it clear who I am. That's called Jnana Yoga. That's day. Now I can't do that. Again, I'm not qualified to do that unless I have a certain kind of lifestyle. It will be almost impossible if my mind is really, really agitated and I'm really extroverted. So I have my bhakti yoga going, I have my karma yoga going, and once those practices are working very well, then it's going to be very easy for me to discriminate. And what will I discriminate? Well, I'll just discriminate myself from the thoughts appearing in me. It's called Atma Anatma Viveka. I just discriminated the not-self from the self. And every minute, there's always only those two things in my experience. There's me, the non-experiencing witness, the awareness, and there's the objects appearing in me. There are physical objects and there are subtle objects. Both physical objects and subtle objects are not me, including all states of mind. Now, once I've got that all going, then I take up meditation. It's the next practice. Unless you've got all this stuff clear, meditation's not going to work. People go 5, 10, 15. I met people, I've got a couple of disciples who were in meditation, who were in different meditation traditions for up to 25 years and never got anywhere. Well, they did. They didn't go backwards. But there was like treading water. They would get agitated, and then they'd go sit and meditate for stress relief. They'd get rid of the stress, and they feel okay, and then they go back to their life, get back, and create the stress all over again, and then go sit and meditate and get rid of it, and then when they went back to their jobs or their families or whatever it is, create the stress again and go back to meditate. And they did back and forth from meditation to stress, right, over and over and over again for 20 years. Some 5 years, 10 years, 15, up to 20, 25 years, people will do this. And one day, this one woman, she said, geez, this isn't working. I don't know why it took her 25 years to figure it out. And within a year and a half, she'd realized herself. Because she understood, the meditation was great because it prepared herself, prepared her. Her lifestyle was good and so forth and so on. And the mind had become, and she had a good sattvic lifestyle. And the meditation had actually calmed her down a lot. But she wasn't really getting anywhere spiritually. So if I've got my karma yoga and my bhakti yoga and my jnana yoga all working for me, then I should take up meditation. Understand? Because meditation steadies the mind and holds it on the self. And when you're holding your mind on the self, obviously what can happen? I can realize what the self is. The knowledge of the self will appear in the meditation. And I can actually see in the reflection. Now look, people, we're not saying you can't get moksha through yoga. I said you couldn't, but maybe you can. You won't actually, it'll be a little different than what you think. We call, in Vedanta, we call yoga a leading error. That's a funny way, isn't it? You call yoga the leading error. That means it's a mistake to think that you can get enlightened by doing yoga, but if you do yoga, you might get enlightened. Why? Because it puts you in the right place. And even though you didn't go there thinking that moksha was knowledge, you may very well discover who you are in meditation. So meditation is very good. There's a great text called Panchadasi. I just did that in India. It's an advanced text. This is we're just talking entry-level Vedanta, but this is quite an advanced text. And it says that yoga is very good. And how does it work? How does this work? As your mind gets more and more sattvic, let's bring in the gunas here. Let's, because the next yoga is the yoga of the three gunas. Let's say this. Say that you have a blank wall here, and the sun is shining on the wall, and your back is to the sun. You can't see the sun, but you can see sunlight on the wall. And in front of the wall there are three buckets. Huh? In one bucket, there's clear, still water. In the next bucket, there's clear water, but there's a fan on it, and it's got all little waves on it. And in the third bucket, there's muddy, dark, still water. And you're given this exercise. You're told, your job is to tell me what the sun is. Now, you're supposed to know, understand what the sun is. You can't see it directly.
Awareness.
Well, you know, from this experience, yeah, it is. But in this experiment now, your job is, you won't know that. You're going to discover this experientially. Okay? Meditation is an experiential way to what? Realize the self. Okay, so if the sun is shining on these three buckets, and there's a reflection on the wall. Three reflections. Now, on that muddy, still bucket, what will you see on the wall?
Shadow.
You won't know. You won't even see a shadow. You'll see nothing. Why? Because the dark, have muddy water will absorb the light. It won't reflect the light. Now this is a condition when your mind is tamasic. When your mind is tamasic, awareness is shining on your mind. Awareness is always shining on your mind. It never stops shining on your mind. 24/7, awareness is shining on your mind. But will you see it in that kind of mind? No. This is why tamasic people say, there's no self. What are you talking about? Are you mad? Huh? The world is full of tamasic people. If you tell them that yourself, that there's a self and it's pure consciousness and it's light of awareness, they'll say, you little cuckoo fella. Huh? Get the little man in white coats. You need medication. You're crazy, because they won't see it. When you have your epiphanies, your mind's not dull. So in a tamasic mind, you'll never experience and know what the self is. Now, in the second bucket, you got water, it's clear, but the water is disturbed by a fan. So there's all kinds of little ripples. So what are you going to see on the, what are you going to think the self is?
Little glimpse.
Yeah, Shakti, energy. Huh? These are your energy people. In the spiritual world, there's a whole world, whole section of the spiritual world, they're all Shakti junkies. We call them Shakti Babas in India. They love that feeling of Shakti, that dancing, exciting energy. That's because what? Awareness is shining on a rajasic mind, and it's producing this feeling of energy. It's very pleasant. It's very exciting and pleasant and stimulating kind of energy. And a lot of people think that that enlightenment is Shakti. The people like Amaji and these people that give are Shaktipad gurus, they're not transmitting enlightenment, they're transmitting Shakti. They have huge, powerful reservoir of Shakti because they've been doing yoga. They've been holding the Shakti inside for a long time. They don't have any, they've blocked all the avenues of escape for the Shakti. The Shakti stays inside, it's kumbhaka, it's concealed. And then they just filter it out either through this chakra or this chakra. If your mind is receptive, then your mind gets excited by the Shakti and you get high and you have an experience of the Shakti. They become Shakti Babas and Shakti worshippers. India is full of them. There's millions, there's maybe 200 million or more Shakti Babas in India. Yes?
Does this mean that these people have rajasic minds?
Yes. Sattva and Rajas. The bucket's clear, but it's dancing. It's lovely Shakti. Nothing wrong with it. My guru had tremendous Shakti. He had a very Rajas of mind. Now, in the third bucket, you have clear, still water. What are you going to see on the wall?
Awareness.
The sun. As it is. It's going to be clear and reflected exactly as it is. And by holding your, if that's why we want the sattvic mind. That's why all of our practices are what? To get the sattvic mind and meditating on that reflection in the sattvic or pure mind, that knowledge will arise. If you read my website, there's must be 200 or 300 emails from people who have had, probably more, I don't know. It's the most common thing in the spiritual world. People who have had these experiences of what? Of the light. It feels like you're out of your body, you're at a distance from everything, or there's just this luminosity everywhere, or you're melted or merged into all objects, or there's just this feeling of total connectedness or love. There are all sorts of different ways in which that experience of non-duality will occur in a sattvic mind. And by what, keeping your mind on that reflection of awareness and contemplating, using the teachings that you've been given, you can extract the knowledge of who you are. You can say, oh, that's me. That thing that's shining there in my mind, eventually will come, you'll discover, who's that? You'll start getting curious. This is called inquiry. And you'll hold your mind tighter and tighter. When you get to a certain level of meditation, you don't care about anything. I tell you, you don't want to eat, you don't want to sleep, you don't want to talk to anybody or see anybody. You're so fascinated by this light that's shining in you. Your mind is just completely fixed or locked on it. Nothing can take it away. Even a big explosion or a tragedy or something, it doesn't bother you. You're just watching, enjoying, getting more and more and more in tune, in touch with this light, bathing in it, And at some point, there's just a little click. There's a shift. And suddenly, you see that you're the light shining on the mind. You're not that person looking in at the light anymore. The light's no longer an object. You are the light looking at your reflection in the mind. And suddenly you've taken the self's position. You've become the self. Not that you became the self, you were always the self before, but through meditation you can affect this, what, this shift, what, in knowledge. And your knowledge goes right along with this. The problem is that people are so overwhelmed by the experience that happens when they're in touch with the self inside themselves, they forget to get the knowledge. They try to keep the experience going, they forget the knowledge, and when they come down, they feel like a fish out of water. Feel so frustrated and so separate, so uncomfortable. And this happens over and over and over again. You get close, you get this experience, everything's beautiful and what, and then the experience ends, you lose your concentration. You break your concentration, the experience ends, and you leave that experience without gaining the knowledge. Yes?
So I read that in the classical tradition in Dayananda centers in India, that there is no spiritual practice. There are 30 minutes of meditation in the morning, but this is just for health care, but there is no such thing as this kind of meditation. Practice. There's just reading scriptures?
No, they do. They do all sorts of other practices. They have bhakti practice and scripture practice and so forth. Well, you don't have to do meditation.
Okay.
No way. Many people don't meditate at all and who get moksha through Vedanta, just simply through hearing and contemplating. You don't have to go in meditation. But if you'll notice here, have you noticed how we get in meditation through these talks? Huh? Yeah. You feel that energy sometimes? Everything's still and quiet? Huh? Well, how did we get into that meditation? That's called Salvikalpa Samadhi. How did we get into, we don't make a big deal out of it. But how did we get into that, these samadhis? How did we get so high and feel so good and everything becomes so quiet and your mind is so still and clear? How does that happen? Simply by knowledge. We remove your ignorance. You're listening, I'm teaching, the ignorance goes away, the veil gets clear, and suddenly you're experiencing yourself. Knowledge is as good as anything. You can chant and get that experience, you can hear the teaching and get that experience, you can practice meditation and get that experience, you can trip on a rock and bump your head and have that experience. We just want to cultivate this experience of what? Of the self, huh? Through in our life. We want to cultivate it. It's the greatest pleasure. You want pleasure, this is the greatest pleasure. Chasing around in the bars and chasing, you know, sex and all these things, those are little pleasures. They're small pleasures. But the pleasure of a pure mind, the pleasure of meditation, nothing like it. Nothing like it. Total, absolute bliss. Clarity, bliss, fullness. What a wonderful experience. So, what's the conclusion I should draw then? That Rajas and Tamas are not suitable for what? For moksha. And I should keep producing, right? Through all my practices, I should develop a very clear, still, luminous, sattvic mind. In which what? The experience of the self and the knowledge of the self can take place. Once I've got all this in place, I don't care whether I get enlightened or not. Why? Why don't you care?
Because you already are.
Yeah, and because you feel good anyway. Yeah, because you already are. You don't care. It's fine. Even if you're enlightened and your mind is not pure, you're going to suffer. Your physical mind, your body and mind are going to suffer. So after enlightenment, you're going to want to be happy, treat yourself nicely, treat your ego and your body nicely. You want to give it a nice experience, you might as well do your sadhana after you got enlightened. So it doesn't matter. If you do it before enlightenment, during enlightenment, or after enlightenment, this is the way to live. Understand? This is the way to live. It's a pure, noble, spiritual life. It's good for you and it's good for everybody around you. Because you're peaceful and you're happy. There's one final little thing on this Triguna Yoga. See, life is about processing experience. This is another way to look at it. Particularly now, particularly in the Kali Yuga and in this day and age, things happen fast. A lot of things happen and they happen fast in a rapid way. If we lived 100 years ago, you might have, you know, one or two interesting experiences a week. Yeah, life was slow. Not much happened. You did your duty. People weren't neurotic. They weren't. There were always a few neurotics. But they weren't, it wasn't like these societies. Everybody's neurotic. They're just buzzing all over the place and worried about everything. And just like, And there's more of us and all our communications are tighter. So we're just forced to deal with more and more and more stuff every year. I mean, just in my short lifetime, the change from the 1950s to the 2010, it's huge. And it's going to go even worse. Why? Because nobody's doing anything about the population of the earth. Nobody's doing anything about that. The population's just going like this, and God's not making any more real estate. There's no place to put these people. They're crowding together, tighter and tighter and tighter, more and more and more compact, and they're just agitating each other. And so we're having to deal with, in one day, we have many, many experiences that we need to lay to rest. If you don't handle the experience that comes right now and get rid of it, what happens to that experience?
Goes in the vasana.
Yeah, it just becomes a vasana. It goes in the subconscious and it sits there till it's processed. Understand? It just remains with you till it's processed. You find people, 60 years old who haven't processed things that happened when they were 5 years old or 7 years old. Some experience took place when they were 4 or 5 or 6 years old, and the thing is still affecting them 40 or 50 years later. They never, ever processed it. I have a friend who was adopted. And her birth mother was quite. She knew that she couldn't take care of this child. She knew, I'm not capable to do it, and she didn't want to do it. And she had enough sense. She, out of an act of compassion for the child, she gave the child to a woman who really wanted that child and really loved that child and really took care of that child beautifully. Gave her an education and did everything for her and set her right in life. And she never said anything too much to the child much until she was a little older. And then she said, you're my adopted daughter. And from that moment, from hearing those words, that woman got a terrible complex about herself. What did she think? She thought, why did my mother give me away? I must have been a bad person. That's what she thought. There must be something wrong with me because my mother gave me away. Well, actually, the fact was, it was really good karma that she got given away. If the mother had kept her, she'd have had an absolutely miserable life. Because the mother was a low-life person, but the mother had enough sense to know that she shouldn't ruin the life of this child, and she gave her to somebody. So Bhagavan looked after this woman and got her all the opportunities, but she had an inferiority complex all her life, and it ruined. She had five marriages. She every single thing went wrong. Because she could never, ever, ever handle that information, process that information, and get it out of there so she could live in the present. She was always trying to prove to herself and to other people that she was okay, that there was nothing wrong with her. There wasn't anything wrong with her. She was a lovely person. So if you don't deal with what comes up on the spot and process it, it's going to stay with you, and it's going to come back, and Bhagavan's going to make you deal with it over and over and over again till you get it right. If your mind is tamasic, if your energy is tamasic, how can you process information properly? How can you process your life? Tamas is darkness and confusion. You'll be always confused. You'll make the wrong decisions. You'll make mistakes. You will not read the situation properly. You'll interpret what's happening wrongly. This was her case. She was tamasic. She took the wrong attitude toward this thing because she couldn't help it, really. She wasn't a yogi. Now she's a great yogi and a realized person. But, it took how many? It took almost 50 years to get over that problem. And then she found Vedanta, and then everything went fine, and now she's a realized person. But you see, now, and if your mind is rajasic, you're too busy to process the information. You look at a rajasic person, go to their house. Usually, it's a mess. Their closets and drawers are just full of stuff. They never throw away anything. They're too busy. They can't get rid of anything. They can't put anything in place. Their mind is like a bunch of, it's just, it's a mess. And you make mistakes in that one too. You can discriminate properly. Information gets distorted by your desires and by your agitation. And so subconsciously you just build up more and more and more vasanas and more and more pressure, more and more. Spiritual food doesn't get digested, and it clogs your spiritual colon. Put it that way. You just get constipated backlog of what? Experience builds up in you, karma. Unresolved karma. If your mind is sattvic, you're clear and alert and still, when something comes up, what? You've got the right values. You've got the value for knowledge, and what can you do? You can find out what's appropriate there, respond appropriately, and lay the problem to rest.
Good digestion.
Good digestion. And if your sattvic mind has what? Has the knowledge of awareness, knowledge of who you are, if your mind is sattvic and it has the knowledge and awareness, you can process anything, boom, 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 boom. You can handle hundreds of experiences in a day and what? And still remain calm. I discovered this when I met my guru. We would see sometimes 100, 200 people, 300 people in a day. He would talk to 50, 70, 80 people in a day, all had problems and things, and he had a big, huge organization, and he was always calm. There were lines to see him. They just lined up, and just one, and he never, ever got agitated, nothing ever stuck, was always clear and still, just was present, handled what had to happen, that person went away, the next thing came, he dealt with that. Whatever it was, business, whatever it was, he was always steady. Just looked at everything from the self's point of view and processed it, because his mind was pure. What?
Didn't you sit here as a very majestic?
Sure.
At the same time?
Same time. Observing the mind. If your mind is vast and still, those little dance of Shakti in your mind is nothing. Anyway, that's your basic story. That's the self, that's the Vedanta story. From the original motivation right on up to what? Realization. It's a whole process. It's a whole teaching. It's a complete teaching. We didn't have time to really get into it. Usually I take on every one of those topics several hours. Some of them more. We can get into any one of them over and over and over again. There's deep, they all open up. It's an amazing tradition. And
thank you for listening. For more information about Vedanta, yoga and self-inquiry, visit shiningworld.com, yogavidya.de or meinyogalehrer.de.